Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The International Organization for Migration said Tuesday that more than 350,000 migrants have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean this year, fleeing turmoil and poverty in the Mideast and Africa in search of a better life in Europe. The intergovernmental agency said that more than 234,000 of them landed on the shores of Greece, with another 114,000 arriving in Italy and much smaller numbers in Spain and Malta. About 2,600 have died, often drowning when overcrowded boats operated by human traffickers have sunk. The latest figures came as Europe continued to cope with one of its biggest streams of migrants since World War II. Hungary is one of the main migrant entry points to the European Union, with more than 156,000 arriving this year. The 28-member EU plans to hold emergency talks on the migrant issue on September 14th. Two more Ukrainian National Guard officers have died from wounds caused by a grenade blast during Monday's violent demonstrations in the capital Kiev, bringing the death toll to three. Officials announced the deaths of the two servicemen Tuesday, a day after nationalists clashed with security forces outside the country's parliament building. The nationalists were protesting constitutional amendments proposed by the government that would give greater autonomy to parts of eastern Ukraine controlled by Russia-backed separatists. The legislation won preliminary parliamentary approval Tuesday. Ukraine's Interior Ministry announced Tuesday that it has called more than 30 people in for questioning in connection with the violence there. This is VOA News. Worries about China's economic growth were sharpened by a disappointing report on that nation's huge manufacturing sector on Tuesday. Prices on the Shanghai market fell sharply at the open, but regained some strength to close at a loss of just under 1.3%, as Chinese officials insisted the situation is under control. Key stock indexes in London, Paris, and Germany were down nearly 3%. U.S. market indexes were off around 2% in midday trading. The developments have been so significant that Japan's finance minister, Taro Aso, suggested on Tuesday that the Chinese economy be a focus of this week's meeting of the group of 20 major economies. Al-Shabaab militants assaulted an African Union base in southern Somalia Tuesday, killing at least 19 soldiers and reportedly taking others hostage. The death toll was provided by a high-ranking Somali official who told VOA that a similar number of AU troops were abducted by Al-Shabaab. A local resident also reported seeing captured soldiers. There was no indication where the troops might have been taken. Gunmen attacked the base, located in the lower Shabelle region, with a car bomb on Tuesday. Al-Shabaab gunmen then entered the camp, triggering a gunfight with AU soldiers. Witnesses told VOA many of the soldiers fled. The World Meteorological Organization reports a strong El Niño is present in the tropical Pacific Ocean and warns it could develop into one of the strongest in history by the end of the year. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports.
During an El Niño event, water in the central and eastern Pacific becomes substantially warmer than normal. El Niño creates a number of weather anomalies, ranging from extremely wet to extremely dry conditions in some regions around the world. Rupa Kumar Kohli is a senior scientist with the World Meteorological Organization. He says climate models suggest water temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean are likely to exceed 2 degrees Celsius above average.
The peak strength of this El Niño, expected sometime during October 2015 to January 2016, could potentially place it among the four strongest El Niño events since 1950.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A local clerk in Kentucky has again refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, despite a recent ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court ordering her to do so. Local media reports that the office of Kim Davis, the elected court clerk in Kentucky's Rowan County, refused licenses to the same-sex marriage couples when Davis told the couples that her office would not be issuing licenses today. When asked by one of the couples under whose authority she was making the decision, she said, under God's
That's
authority.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
What was unexpected was coming from such violent locations and having all these catastrophes happening all at once, you know, not just civil war in Syria and chaos in Libya, but also Ebola, natural disaster. You had strife in places like Sudan and Somalia that who could predict it would go on for 40 years. I mean, those kinds of things have driven a lot of this movement, and that was something that probably no one was really prepared for.
That's Joel Billman, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. More than 350,000 migrants have risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean this year. We'll have details coming up.
Also, Al-Shabaab militants driving a car loaded with explosives have rammed the entry of an African Union military base south of Somalia's capital.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, says more than 350,000 migrants have risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea so far this year. In addition, some 2,600 have lost their lives while making the perilous journey to Europe. The latest figures from IOM show that the largest number of migrants, almost 235,000, have landed in Greece. Another 114,000 made it to Italy. Smaller numbers of arrivals reach Spain and the island of Malta. Joel Millman is a spokesperson for IOM. He explains why the high number of migrants is really not an alarming number to them, but at the same time, it is a situation Europe must get a handle on.
We think this is an inevitability based on Europe's demographic needs and also the needs of the emerging countries of North Africa, Central Africa, Horn of Africa, and, of course, the Middle East. There's a terrible imbalance between a continent with a falling birth rate, yet an enormously developed economy, and a lack of new workers coming into the workforce. And then, of course, the other side, the parts of the world where there are just far too many young people with skills who can't find employment. So we know they're going to meet somewhere, and migration is probably the most efficient way. Instead of waiting for resettlement or waiting for an opportunity, people nowadays know they're going to get on the road and take care of themselves. What was unexpected was coming from such violent locations and having all these catastrophes happening all at once, you know, not just civil war in Syria and chaos in Libya, but also Ebola, natural disaster. You had strife in places like Sudan and Somalia that who could predict it would go on for 40 years. I mean, those kinds of things have driven a lot of this movement, and that was something that probably no one was really prepared for. But the next step has to be ways to identify the future flows and manage them. And we also think that when there is stability in some of the center countries, Europe will have the opportunity to engage with the government as their partners and collaborators in fashioning some kind of migrant flow that's regulated and easy to predict. And I tell people that, you know, the U.S. until this year was in a state of war with Cuba for over 50 years, and yet they still talked about migration. They still got together, their diplomats, our diplomats, and came up with a framework that would allow 20,000 people from Cuba every year to get a visa to come to the U.S. because they knew the consequence of not doing that, which is thousands of people dying in the Caribbean on unsafe rafts. To some degree, that still happens, so we think that's in Europe's future as well.
In talking about migration, a lot of times you hear migrants and refugees, the two terms or descriptions interchangeable. Are these people that are trying to get into Europe, you all are calling them migrants, but you also hear the term refugees.
Well, we don't consider it interchangeable. I'm glad you asked the question, because for us, refugee is a subset of migrant. Asylum seeker is a subset of refugee. It can get a little confusing because what could be a migrant today, you know, an economic migrant, someone who leaves their country looking for better employment, could turn into a refugee depending on the conditions of what happens to that person on their route. They could get kidnapped. They could get coerced. They could be forced into prostitution, you know, which raises to a different level what we think has happened to them. So I wouldn't categorically say that it's one or the other, but migrant covers everybody, and we talk of mixed migration, and the mix would be between refugees who are fleeing conflict and leaving their country for that reason, and economic migrants who are looking for better employment.
Are they being registered or screened properly so far with the huge influx of them going into Europe?
Not properly enough. Italy's done a very good job. Greece has been overwhelmed. The question is, what should happen to them and where should they ask for asylum? Should it be right where they arrive, or should they have options to go to the countries where their families may already be settled? And that's really what Europe's stuck trying to figure out right now.
Are other European countries outside of Italy and Greece, are they stepping up to take on some of the migrants?
They're getting better at it. Some are getting worse at it. But in general, it's really come up this summer. I think we realize now, looking back, that the summer weather created a lot of people who've been waiting around in Turkey for months to start making those short journeys to Greece, which probably weren't safe to do earlier in the year. And they did so in such enormous numbers, nobody was quite prepared. Looking forward, we hope the numbers come down because of the cold weather coming, although that does not always happen. And then we'll see. It's hard to predict the best policy when you don't know how many people you're going to be dealing with. But probably we'll know later this year, you know, what the rest of the year looks like.
That was Joel Millman, a spokesperson for IOM. He spoke with me from Geneva.
In related news, migrants' flows from Turkey to the heart of the European Union remains unchecked. Today, two chartered ferries are carrying 4,000 migrants from two Greek islands to Athens. Many of them had been sleeping on the streets of villages on Lesbos and Kos Islands. They are expected to continue by bus or on foot from Greece through Macedonia and Serbia to Hungary. Hungary is a gateway to the European Union. Hungary has shut down its eastern railway station in Budapest, banning more than 1,000 protesting migrants from boarding trains to Austria and Germany. Over 156,000 migrants have entered Hungary this year. Around 142,000 have requested asylum. Also, the European Union's border agency Frontex reports that many migrants are carrying fake Syrian passports being sold in Turkey.
Al-Shabaab militants have attacked an African Union base in southern Somalia today, killing at least 19 soldiers and taking others hostage. A high-ranking Somali official told VOA's Somali service that some AU troops were abducted by Al-Shabaab. A local resident also reported seeing soldiers who were captured by the militants. The gunmen attacked the AU base at Janale in the lower Shabelle region with a car bomb before dawn today. Al-Shabaab gunmen then entered the camp, triggering a gunfight with AU soldiers. Witnesses told VOA that many of the soldiers fled. The AU mission in Somalia, AMISOM, says its troops regained full control of the base after making a tactical withdrawal. The AMISOM base is in Janale, a small farming town about 120 kilometers south of Mogadishu. The attack occurred exactly 1 year after Al-Shabaab's longtime leader, Ahmed Abdi Ghadani, was killed by a U.S. drone strike. In June, Al-Shabaab attacked another AMISOM base in the same region, killing more than 50 soldiers from Burundi. Al-Shabaab claims they attacked the base in response to reports that Ugandan soldiers killed six Somalis at a wedding in July. Human Rights Watch last month urged the Ugandan government to investigate and prosecute any soldiers responsible for the deaths at the wedding. AMISOM soldiers have been fighting Al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. AMISOM forces and Somali troops have recaptured large parts of Somalia from the Al-Qaeda-linked militants in recent years, but attacks have continued. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Suhiben at 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says more than 350,000 migrants have risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea so far this year. And Al-Shabaab militants driving a car loaded with explosives have rammed the entry of an African Union military base south of Somalia's capital. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Representatives from more than 190 countries are meeting in Bonn, Germany for climate talks. The negotiations this week and again in October in Bonn lead up to December's major climate summit in Paris. Among those attending the talks is David Wasko. He's director of the International Climate Action Initiative at the World Resources Institute. From Bonn, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCampua about the issues being negotiated.
The negotiations deal with a set of key issues for addressing climate change, both the causes and the consequences of climate change. So many discussions on emissions and how to move on to low carbon pathways, as well as discussions about how to work with countries to adapt to and build resilience to the impacts of climate change. And then, of course, it's critically important to work through how one deals with this over the long term, setting long-term goals for those, and also ensuring that countries return to the negotiating table at regular intervals so that Paris really is a turning point and countries will come back on a regular basis to continue to ramp up action.
What is the mood around these talks? Is it more optimistic than in years past?
I think there's quite a bit of optimism about reaching a strong agreement in Paris. And I think a sense that a universal climate agreement that really has everyone on board is possible. And there's quite a ways to go, but the progress has been steady. And negotiators this week are laying out the core elements of what they want to see in the final agreement. And they won't fully come to an understanding on that, but really reaching clarity this week, I think, is possible in terms of how countries see what needs to be in the agreement, and then also some associated decisions that will come out of Paris.
What issues do you want to see negotiated?
This is really an opportunity to put the world on a clear pathway to reducing emissions, to achieving low carbon pathways, and also to building resilience to climate impacts. And so having clear signals come out of Paris that the world is headed in those directions, that low-carbon economies and resilient economies are inevitable, that's key. It's also critically important that there be a process so that countries do come back to the table at regular intervals, and that has to be done in a timely way. So countries, for example, need to have clarity that they'll be back in 5 years, in 2020, again, for a major summit to ramp up action again. And if you think back over the last 5 years, things have changed quite a lot. There's been a rapid fall in the price of renewable energy, solar in particular. We've seen the science change, and we understand much better the impacts that are being faced in terms of water scarcity, loss of glaciers, threats of forest fires, all of these things from climate change. Awareness of climate change has changed. You see things like the Pope and the encyclical that he released that underscored the degree to which the world is aware of the consequences, and also much greater awareness of the opportunities. There are many economic opportunities, including in renewable energy, to be seized from taking action.
David Wasko is director of the International Climate Action Initiative at the World Resources Institute. From Bonn, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The UN Human Rights Office says it deplores the resumption of executions in Chad, where 10 people were put to death on Saturday under a newly enacted anti-terrorism law. Lisa Schlein reports from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
This is the first use of the death penalty in Chad since the country declared a moratorium in 2003. The United Nations Human Rights Office calls this a big step backward. The agency says it also is concerned about the speed with which the executions were carried out. Spokeswoman Cécile Pouilly says 10 men were executed by firing squad on August 29th, one day after they were sentenced to death under the new anti-terrorism law. She tells VOA the men were said to be members of Nigerian militant group Boko Haram and were accused of involvement in terrorist attacks that killed more than 50 people in Chad's capital N'Djamena in June and July. Puyi says the UN has concerns about the fairness of the men's trial.
According to the information that we collected, the timing of the trial was reduced from 8 to 2 days, and it was relocated for security reasons. We don't have information whether they had access to lawyers, whether they were able to appeal against their sentence.
Puyi says the UN Human Rights Office has not yet talked to Chadian authorities about this case, but has been in regular touch with them on questions regarding the death penalty.
We had welcomed the decision to adopt a new penal code that was abolishing death penalty, so it's really a big step backward, a big disappointment for us. And we have been asking the Chadians to adopt the second optional protocol on civil and political rights, which de facto would lead to the end of the use of death penalty in Chad.
The UN agency is calling on Chad to review its anti-terrorism legislation. It says the law contains a very vague definition of terrorism, which may not be legal internationally and potentially could put many people at risk of execution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Former Congolese warlord Bosco Ntaganda goes on trial in The Hague tomorrow for alleged atrocities committed in the DRC more than a decade ago. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Nicknamed the Terminator, Bosco Ntaganda spent years as a rebel leader in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. But the 18 charges against him narrowly relate to fighting in DRC's Ituri region between 2002 and 2003. They include murder, attempted murder, attacks against civilians, and sexual slavery. Speaking at a press conference ahead of the trial's opening, ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said Ntaganda's behavior has raised alarms far beyond DRC and the surrounding Great Lakes region.
We believe he ordered his troops to attack, pillage, rape, persecute, and kill civilians belonging to Lendu, Ngiti, and other ethnic groups. And we believe he recruited hundreds of children into the UPC and used them to kill and to die in the fighting, and girl soldiers to be routinely raped.
Ntaganda has pleaded not guilty. His lawyer, Stéphane Bourgon, described the case as complex.
Je me contenterai de dire à ce sujet.
He said the context in which the events took place was key and warned against the temptation of jumping to conclusions. Following a peace deal with the government in 2009, Ntaganda was made a general in the army. But in 2012, he formed a new rebel group called the M23. A year later, he surrendered to the U.S. Embassy in neighboring Rwanda and was transferred to ICC custody at The Hague. Human Rights Watch has called Ntaganda's trial a victory for victims and their families and for rights activists across the eastern DRC. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
As the Ebola virus outbreak diminishes in Liberia, unions and civil society groups are beginning to question how the government spent money allocated to fight the outbreak. Chris Stein has the story.
Liberia is expected to be declared once again free of the Ebola virus later this week. But people are starting to question what happened to all the money allocated to fight the outbreak. Over 4,800 Liberians died from the disease since its outbreak in the country in 2014. The country was declared free of the disease in May, but it reemerged weeks later. International donors pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to help the impoverished country fight the virus. Lamy Pargoy, the head of civil society group Liberia Media Center, says his group has launched a project to account for how that money was spent.
So we are looking at every funding that came in to respond to the Ebola outbreak, whether it's doing an actual outbreak or doing a post-outbreak situation.
Some are already crying foul. Health workers have recently taken to the streets of the capital, Monrovia, saying they have not been paid by the government for work they did during the outbreak, like contact tracing, where they find people who came into contact with Ebola patients. George Williams is the Secretary General of the National Health Workers Association of Liberia.
Government said they were paying health workers salaries of $500, salaries plus incentives. And that is not the reality.
Adolphus Ye, a health officer from Margibi County outside the capital, says the local government relies on foreign donors to pay the salaries of its volunteers and contact tracers, money it has not received.
We do not have the resources to pay contact tracers. We have not paid contact tracers.
A new death from Ebola was reported in Sierra Leone on Monday, and will likely be months before the two other West African countries hit hard by the outbreak, Sierra Leone and Guinea, are declared free of the virus. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
If breast cancer recurs after seemingly successful chemotherapy and surgery, it is notoriously difficult to treat. But what if doctors could detect the cancer's genetic maternal material months before the tumors were to reappear? As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, doctors say such a blood test might give women a fighting chance.
Breast cancer is one of the leading causes of cancer death among women. It's caught early about 95% of the time, and a simple operation can remove the tumor. Chemotherapy can follow surgery to try to kill cancer cells that might have gotten away. But some women who seem to be cured experience a recurrence, with metastatic cancer cells reestablishing tumors at distant sites, including the liver and brain. Nicholas Turner is an oncologist at the Institute of Cancer Research in London, England.
We know, unfortunately, chemotherapy doesn't work in everybody. And what we need are tests to help work out whether there's cancer left after chemotherapy to help us direct treatment.
In an article published in Science Translational Medicine, Turner and his colleagues describe being able to detect DNA from tumor cells circulating in the blood. The technique uses highly sensitive genetic sequencing to track tumor-specific mutations from cells that split off from the original cancer. Investigators took regular blood samples for 2 years from 55 women with early-stage breast cancer who'd been treated with surgery and chemotherapy and were considered cancer-free. Eventually, 15 patients relapsed, but researchers had detected the cancer DNA in a dozen of the women an average of 8 months before the tumors could be seen with mammograms or other conventional imaging. For now, says Turner, not much can be done to help patients whose tumors have spread.
But we can't cure those women. So what we need to be able to try and do is identify them much earlier at the point where there is relatively few cancer cells, where treatments stand a chance of potentially clearing it.
And because the test focuses on mutations in the tumor cells, researchers say that information could help doctors select the most effective drugs for targeting the cancer. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S. African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says more than 350,000 migrants have risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea so far this year. And Al-Shabaab militants driving a car loaded with explosives have rammed the entry of an African Union military base south of Somalia's capital. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, Cameroon bans imported vegetable oil from Indonesia and Malaysia to protect its home industries. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Woohee Band. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African football tops your sports report today.
Kim, joining us once again this evening is David Legg, our African football guru. David, welcome back to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Thank you very much, Sunny. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Took a little break, but getting back into the football fever, David, and I know African football fans are looking forward to the resumption of the qualifying competition for Gabon 2017, the Africa Cup of Nations. How about taking a look at the upcoming matches for us?
We've got match day two coming up this weekend. We take it group by group. Group A, we've got Djibouti against Togo. That is the only match on Friday. And you've got Liberia against Tunisia. Now, Djibouti, with home advantage over Togo, will be hoping they don't get a roasting as they did in match day one when they conceded 8 goals in Tunisia. I'm afraid Djibouti, Sonny, are the whipping boys of African football. They've had quite a few heavy defeats. The good news, I think, is they won't concede 8. The bad news is I do expect Togo will win that match in the Horn of Africa. A much closer game should be that between Liberia and Tunisia. Now, Tunisia, off to that great start with an 8-1 victory. Liberia, on the other hand, losing 2-1 away to Togo. And, of course, great news for all Liberian football fans. They've been given the all clear as far as the Ebola epidemic is concerned. And that is tremendous news for that country in West Africa. And I know a lot of people there listen into the Sunny Side of Sport. And we send them a big welcome and hi. The good news for Liberia is I believe they have a good chance. Tunisians are very strong at home, but they don't always travel particularly well. And if the Liberians can get stuck in, legally, of course, just hard tackles, but nothing vicious, and play a good game and get that first goal, they may well have a chance, Sonny, of an upset there in the other Group A match. Turning to Group B, the matches are Central African Republic at home to Democratic Republic of Congo and Madagascar at home to Angola. And one match I'm really looking forward to is Madagascar against Angola. And the reason is Madagascar did very well in the Castle Cup Southern African competition. What I want to see is can they reproduce that form and even improve on it in the tougher environment. Now, Angola had a good 4-0 home victory over Central African Republic in their first match, so they're going to offer quite a challenge to the Malagasies. If Malagasy are as good as I think they are, they could well spring a surprise and win that game. Central African Republic, on the other hand, that very poor start, conceding 4 away goals, while DR Congo won 2-1 at home to Madagascar. And the Congolese, I think, will expect to come back from Bangui with at least 1 point. On to Group C at the moment is Mali 3 points, Benin and Equatorial Guinea with 1 each, and South Sudan with none. Now, South Sudan, they will have home advantage over Equatorial Guinea, and we must remember that Equatorial Guinea earlier this year finished 4th as hosts of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, and they want to get their campaign back on track after a rather disappointing start, only drawing 1-1 at home with Benin. Benin, on the other hand, they host Mali. It's a West African derby, and I think we could see an upset here. Benin, I think, are up for the fight, and they could even beat Mali and throw Group C wide open. In Group D, it began with two predictable 2-0 home victories for Burkina Faso over the Comores and for Uganda over Botswana. And this time, the two winners are on the road. Burkina Faso are in Botswana, and Uganda are in the Comores. Uganda's coach, Shredder Jovic, better known as Micho, he has said that the Comoros game is actually the most vital one in the group. He says if we can get a win there, we have a real chance of qualifying for the Africa Cup of Nations for the first time since 1978. And I know some of your colleague, Douglas, he was very exuberant when he saw this grouping of Burkina Faso, Uganda, Botswana, and the Comoros. And yes, indeed, I think the Ugandan Cranes and the Stallions from Burkina Faso are going to fight it out for first place in this group. In Group E, it's really interesting because Congo Brazzaville and Zambia, the two more fancy teams, were both held at home on match day one, and now they have to travel. Zambia are in Kenya, and Congo are in Guinea-Bissau. That's a long trip, and the Guinea-Bissau team, very impressive in their first match, holding Zambia 0-0 in Dola. And dare I say, we could have Kenya and Guinea-Bissau with victories, leading the group with Zambia and Congo-Brazzaville trailing. The first matches in Group F were really contrasting. You had a 7-1 victory for Cape Verde over Sao Tome e Principe, and you had a 1-0 victory for Morocco over Libya. On this occasion, it's Libya against Cape Verde and Sao Tome against Morocco. I think the easier one to predict is that Morocco will go to the island of Sao Tome and win. Libya and Cape Verde, that one strikes me is going to be a close affair. In Group G, well, it's one of the two groups of death because you've got Egypt and Nigeria. Egypt, record 7-time African champions. Nigeria, 3 times winners of the Cup of Nations. Now, both sides could qualify because the best two runners-up also go through. But to do that, I think a runner-up is going to need 12 points, and that's a tall order. In other words, you're going to have to win possibly 2 home games and also 2 away games. And this weekend, both Egypt and Nigeria are on the road. I think Egypt have got marginally the easier tie. They're away to Chad in N'Djamena, where the heat is often as big a challenge for the visiting team as the actual local footballers. It gets up sunny to 40 degrees Celsius in Chad. And playing in the middle of the afternoon in 40 degrees is certainly not my idea of much fun. Nigeria, on the other hand, they'll probably prefer a nice cool breeze coming in from the Indian Ocean when they play in Dar es Salaam against Tanzania. And I think Egypt and Nigeria will both be very conscious of the fact that they need to try and get maximum points before they face each other twice within a week next March. Group H, we saw Ghana hammering poor little Mauritius 7-1, and Rwanda a good away victory in Mozambique by 1-0. The next matches there, we're going to see Mauritius against Mozambique, so that's a battle of the two match day one losers. And then we got Rwanda against Ghana, which is the top of the table one. Now, our Ghanaian listeners, certainly those in their 20s and 30s, they will have very sad memories of the last time that the Black Stars went to Rwanda. It's a good 10 years ago, Sonny. Ghana were firm favorites to win. It was a Nations Cup qualifier, but Rwanda shocked them by 1-0. And that will no doubt give the Rwandans some hope. In a match, you would expect the Black Stars to win, and you would also expect Mozambique to win in Mauritius. Group I has only got 3 teams, and it's the first appearance by the defending champions, Ivory Coast. They're going to play Sierra Leone in Lagos, and that is correct, not a mistake on my behalf. Unfortunately, the Ebola virus is still a major problem in Sierra Leone, and in recent times, they've been particularly unfortunate in that they cannot find a neutral venue, and they've had to play their home games at the ground of their opponents. But the Nigerian Football Federation, to their great credit, have said to Sierra Leone, come and play in Lagos. We will offer you a sort of home away from home. And I salute the Nigerians for that. I think it's a wonderful gesture. Whether it's going to be enough for Sierra Leone to shock the Ivorians, I doubt it. But on the other hand, the Ivorians are going to miss some of their key players, including the Manchester City pair. Wilfred Bonny is injured. And Yaya Toure, the 4-time African Footballer of the Year, he has said that he needs a break. He needs a rest. In fact, there is a question mark about his international future with the Ivory Coast at the moment. But if I'm a betting man, I'll say a narrow victory there for the Ivory Coast. On Sunny to Group J, and here we've got Lesotho hosting Algeria, the number 1 ranked country in Africa. The Sutu always put up a good fight in Maseru, but you've got to fancy the Algerians to win that one. And then you've got Seychelles against Ethiopia. Ethiopia, not normally the best of travelers, but if they've got any ambitions of doing well in the Cup of Nations qualifiers, this is a match they must win. In Group K, it's Burundi against Niger and Namibia against Senegal. Namibia, the recent winners of the Southern African Championship, this is a chance to really test just how good they are up against the Senegalese, a side that looks particularly strong in attack. And Burundi and Niger, difficult one to call that in Bujumbura. Group L is the strange one, Sonny, in that in the first round of matches, both games ended in away victories, and that is unusual in the African Cup of Nations. Zimbabwe went to Malawi and won 2-1, and an even bigger shock was Swaziland going to Morocco, which is the temporary home for Guinea because of the Ebola epidemic, and the Swazis won by 2-1. And on this occasion, Swaziland are at home to Malawi and Zimbabwe at home to Guinea. And if the Swazis and the Zimbabweans can win, they will be level on 6 points, but perhaps even more significant, they will be 6 points ahead of the Guineans and the Malawians, turning this group into what essentially would be a two-horse race. So for Swaziland and Zimbabwe, an awful lot to play for. The other group of death is Group M, and this was expected to be a real clash between Cameroon and South Africa. But Mauritania and Gambia seem to have other ideas. The Mauritanians held Cameroon for 90 minutes before conceding the only goal of the game in Yaoundé. And if ever there was a moral victory in defeat, it was that for Mauritania. On the other hand, in Durban, Gambia went one better by holding South Africa to a goalless draw. This weekend, it's Gambia against Cameroon, and that's going to be a tough test for Cameroon in Banjul, and Mauritania against South Africa in Nouakchott. Now, if South Africa were to lose this game, I am going to put my head on the block, Sonny, and say they will have no chance of qualifying for 2017. Mm. And for a side with ambitions of winning the Cup of Nations and going to the World Cup in Russia in 2018, that would be nothing less than a disaster with capital D-I-S-A-S-T-E-R. And I think it's going to be tough. I think the South African coach, Sheikh Mashaba, hit the nail on the head when he said, we have got to score first. If South Africa can see the first goal, I can see them in real difficulties. And all those matches again, Sonny, just to reiterate, they will be played on Friday, Saturday or Sunday. They will be the match day two fixtures, and then match day three and four will come up in March of next year.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, in New York City, American tennis star Serena Williams quickly and easily won her opening match as she bids for a fourth consecutive U.S. Open title and a calendar year Grand Slam. Serena was on the court for only 27 minutes. She won the first eight games before her Russian opponent, Vitalia Dyachenko, retired with a foot injury. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahya's Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Kenya, a tech company has created a smart way to improve road safety on the busy, bustling streets of Nairobi. Next, Cameroon banning imported vegetable oil from Indonesia and Malaysia to protect its home industries. But first, some music. Here is Afro National from Sierra Leone with Yorne Yorne.
Dunia, 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 dunia. Kere, olupso subeka kaboma gegege. Oya mone, sabe sachik, sudegbo korika dunia. Thank you.
Coimba, ma fuma lo mayone, yone, yon canunia. Mine coimba, ma fuma lo mayone, yone, canunia. We mutemba, mutemne, we mulaco, we fula, we mubeti, we fulke, malusa sube la cabuma. Mine coimba, ma fuma lo mayone, yone, canunia. Coimba, ma fuma la mayone, yone, canunia. Mine coimba, ma fuma la mayone, yone, canunia.
National from Sierra Leone with Yorne Yorne.
Well, fatal traffic accidents are up by 4.5% in Kenya compared to last year, according to Kenya's Transport Authority. A Nairobi-based wearable tech company has created a smart way to improve road safety on the busy, bustling streets of the nation's capital.
With a growing economy and increased vehicles on the streets, more Nairobi residents are opting for the two-wheel mode of transportation. Their size means they can easily squeeze through traffic. But the popularity comes at a cost. Accidents have led to the loss of many lives, some due to motorcycle drivers ignoring road rules, others due to drivers not spotting the bikes. On average, each year, 3,000 people are killed and another 10,000 are injured in traffic accidents. 29-year-old Joseph Kiriyiku has been a motorcycle taxi operator for 5 years. He's had several near-death experiences.
Many of our people die, most deaths being caused by motor vehicles on the road. Most motor vehicle drivers do not respect us on the road. They would rather not brake and risk hitting the car in front, but would rather hit the guy on the bike.
Charles Muchin, the CEO of Nairobi-based wearable tech company Cladlight, decided to solve this problem by creating a smart jacket, which links up to a motorcycle indicator system.
One of the ideas that came up is to increase the visibility of an individual motorcyclist by just elevating their indication system, which is lowly placed due to the size of the motorcycle, naturally. So now putting the indication system on the jacket, that elevates it, and as a motorist, you can now see the indication system clearly in case of braking or turning left or right.
With a sensor fixed under the motorcycle seat into its existing indicator system, a wireless connection automatically connects the jacket to the vehicle's lights.
This is the transmitter circuit that is installed on the bike. It's a less than 5 minutes installation. So basically, I use bullet connectors and just plug into the already existing indication system.
The director of safety at the National Transport and Safety Authority says the smart jacket could encourage young people to embrace safety.
I'm sure upon release in the market, we see many people wanting to look cool in this kind of jackets. It's perfectly within the law for them to have a jacket that has indicators for both, you know, directional and the brake lights. It should be consistent with what we have on the rest of the motor vehicle. So I do not foresee a problem in its use.
That was Carolyn Turner reporting.
Cameroon says it's banning and destroying cheap vegetable oil imported from Indonesia and Malaysia to protect its home industries. The government says thousands of workers may lose their jobs if the country continues to import cheaper vegetable oil. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaounde.
Aurelius Mbui, an official of Cameroon's agro-industrial company, the Cameroon Development Corporation, CDC, says the jobs of about 16,000 employees in six oil palm estates are threatened as a result of what he calls the unhealthy competition domestically produced refined vegetable oil faces. He says after examining the situation, Cameroon's prime minister ordered that imported vegetable oil must sell at about $3 per litre, which is about a dollar per liter more than domestic oil. If it does not sell at that higher price, it will be seized.
There were certain norms that were set indicating that oil that is imported in this country must be imported at a valued price of 1,500 francs, and that oil must be in specific containers, and it should have vitamin A. But of recent, we've noticed that oil has been imported at prices lower than 1,500.
Cameroon has a huge appetite for vegetable oil. Its own companies produce 32,000 liters every month, according to the Cameroon Association of Vegetable Oil Producers, and an additional 20,000 liters per month has been imported, mainly from Malaysia and Indonesia. Jacques Kemble Chagbu, Secretary General of Cameroon's Association of Oil Producers, says many people were rushing for the imported vegetable oil because it is so much cheaper than locally produced oil.
We cannot accept that. We have four factories which has closed now, and a lot of factory is working in something like 50% of the capacity because you cannot produce when you cannot sell.
Economist Dr. Ariel Njitedem of the University of Yaounde 1 disagrees with the ban and says Cameroon should instead have made its vegetable oil more competitive and of good quality. He says the ban was hastily conceived and may anger the World Trade Organization, WTO, of which Cameroon is a member.
We cannot close our market to the rest of the world. That would be against the WTO regulations. That can allow other countries to refuse our product too.
Cameroon already has a 40% unemployment rate. Government officials say the decision to ban the imports was made in order to save thousands of jobs. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fostering economic development in sub-Saharan Africa is a top priority of the United States, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, is the centerpiece of our trade policy on the continent. Government officials, business leaders, and civil society from African countries and the U.S. are meeting in Gabon's capital, Libreville, this week to discuss how AGOA, now 15 years old, can provide even more business and investment opportunities for Africa's people today and into the future. Statistics support a growing consensus in both Africa and the United States that freer trade and increased international investment are critical to spurring economic development and reducing poverty. The U.S. Congress enacted AGOA in May 2000, providing a wide range of African products duty-free access to the U.S. market. AGOA has succeeded in helping eligible nations grow, diversify their exports to the United States, and create employment and inclusive economic growth. By 2014, African countries' non-oil AGOA exports to the United States were valued at $4.4 billion, up roughly 250% from 2001. The growth of these non-oil industries has spurred an estimated 300,000 direct jobs in beneficiary countries. AGOA's success won overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, which this summer voted to reauthorize the program for another 10 years. That underscores our nation's commitment to a stronger U.S.-Africa trade relationship and support for the region's long-term economic growth. The new AGOA legislation has an added clause, specifically calling for the promotion of the role of women in social, political, and economic development in sub-Saharan Africa. This acknowledges the vital role that women play as economic and civic leaders across the continent. Discussions during this year's forum will explore ways to build strong, export-oriented businesses and prepare African women producers to integrate more fully into regional and global supply chains. The 2015 forum will provide an opportunity to celebrate the recent reauthorization of AGOA, take stock of its successes over the last 15 years, look to the next 10, and launch a dialogue on our shared vision for the future of U.S.-Africa trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S.-African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA Joint Conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.